work, as you will see, progressed, it's actually didn't really apply to the land all that much. However, let me, before I forget, because I know I will forget at the end of my talk, okay, so I want to thank the organizers, right? And the speaker of all this week. And most importantly, for you guys to stick around this to the very end. And I also realize that the last obstacle between you and also say the weekend. Okay? And so I'll try to make it as light as I can. So this is working in collaboration with Rich McLaughlin, who's a colleague of mine at UNC. Terry Joe graduated last year. So this is a good chunk of this work is her thesis. And collaboration with, a whole bunch of people, as you will see in a second. But mainly for this work, Jane Howe, who's a graduate student, graduated, in fact, last year with Terry Joe. They work very closely together, and that's actually a very nice example of interaction between, this guy is in physics, so he's not too far from math, but nonetheless working on an experiment. And Rich Superfine is a faculty in physics, and you can talk this last name if you are a physicist. I mean, it's very, very, very hard, I believe. Okay, and as Rich Superfine, in fact, is fond to put it, and we've seen it, in this workshop, quite a bit, and it's very reassuring to see the developments, the most recent developments in this direction. You wouldn't think of boarding, say, a flight nowadays without full confidence that the plane behavior has been modeled, analyzed, understood, and everything is under control. With the standards of science, in which you observe, make a model, make a theory, predict, going back into the lab, and modify your parameters and check that your model behaves and predicts. In medicine, we're not quite there yet, and the way Rich puts it is, we're not there yet because the system, of course, is very much more complicated than aerodynamics and ailerons. On the other hand, our technology is advancing, and it's advancing very fast. We've seen it in this workshop. And so maybe the time is now to set some ambitious goals, even though you know that you're not quite there yet, and bring this body of work, our biology, or some snippet of it anyway, within the fold of testable science. Okay, what does that mean? Well, I mean, it means that maybe you want to duplicate your biological system in a way that allows you to test, change parameters, check your models or your theory. And one place where we got sucked in, no pun intended, is the lung. And the reason why is because people at UNC started a cystic fibrosis center, and one of the things that didn't get mentioned too much, I think, in this workshop is, but certainly is very, very important in cystic fibrosis, is the fact that people can't breathe, they choke on their own mucus. And the mucus, I'm preaching to the choir here, but anyway, the epithelium cells of the airways are sprouting cilia. The cilia are responsible for clearing mucus. Mucus is secreted by these cells. Mucus is basically some very nasty fluid, nasty in the sense of rheology. Okay, its function, possibly the most important one, is to trap things from the air that would be bad for you, right? And trap them, literally, stick to them, and then clearing the mucus, you get rid of this nasty stuff. So this is a cross section of an epithelium with the cilia here. And what these people at the Cystic Fibrosis Center are doing is actually grow human airway cells, epithelium epithelium cells in vitro in petri dishes. So the cross section is like this. These cells secrete, make their own mucus. Mucus is a pretty thick layer, about 200 nanometers, micrometers or so, and the distance between the tip of the cilia and the base of the cell is about 7 microns or so. The cilia are about 100 or so nanometers now in diameter, and what they do, as far as anybody can tell, is move the mucus. So what went on here while I was speaking is a top view of this petri dish, and I don't know if you notice it, but you'll notice it if I manage to move this. The cilia are actually doing something. Okay, so what you see is in fact stuff that is being secreted by the cells, and looks like dark stuff. And the cilia, if you actually pay attention, you can even, depending on the resolution of the screen, you can actually see them agitating underneath. And the funny thing is, interesting thing is, the cilia do know that they are in a cylindrical geometry because they move the mucus in a hurricane-like fashion. Mm-hmm. Okay, so the feedback could be, this is an indication, that it could be physical, I mean hydrodynamic, in fact. Not only that, but about 80% of these cultures do not develop coordinated motion of the cilia. So the cilia are actually moving their own each other way, and they do not propel the mucus in any particular way. But when you actually shear with a lid, okay, the cultures, they actually do develop coordinated motion, about another 15% or so. And then there is a leftover 5% that refuses to cooperate. But in any case, this is an indication that maybe the hydrodynamic feedback is an important one in making coordinated motion. So another example of the role of physics in this business. So here is actually a picture or a movie, in fact, of this side view and top view of cilia, of the cilia's close-up on the microscope. And you can see the type of motion that the coordinated motion that they have. Okay, and it is thought that this is a good part of the story about moving mucus around, and in fact from the inside of your lung towards your mouth where it gets expelled. Now, these cilia are not just peculiar to lungs. In fact, they are presumably actually an evolution product or process, and they are everywhere in the body, in the human body, where there is need to move fluid around, but not in a hurry, unlike blood. And they are in organs, in the embryo, which we'll see in a moment, actually. And of course, they are everywhere in nature as single cell or low cell number organisms. So in particular, we've seen again the epithelium cells of the lung, and they're also in proportion of sperm, for instance, and they're an efficient tool, right, for moving things around. So much so that if you don't exercise, that could happen to you, right? So it's definitely, if you only attend to say occasional reproductive processes, you definitely have a lot of energy to spare, right? And one thing that is in the embryo is another example of moving fluid around being important to the development of the embryo. So this is an example that comes from this paper. These are mice embryo in about 10 days or so of their development. There's a stage in which the embryo needs to be moving fluid around again, as I said. There is a region of the embryo that develops this little indentation or cavity or valley with this cilia, which are moving in a very much rigid fashion, unlike the cilia of the lung. And they're doing some sort of conical procession. And they're thought of playing a role in the development. And again, another example of the influence of physics in the development is these guys have actually forced, well, first of all, they had pods, for putting the embryo in, and the force flow counteracting the natural way that the cilia would move the fluid. And what happened, they developed mice with this Cartagena syndrome, which is actually known in humans too. It's a situation in which you have this inverted symmetry, so your heart is to the left, right? And sometimes you have the heart to the right. These people actually, as well as the mice, presumably, have all sorts of problems. It's not just the heart in the wrong place. Everything that has to do with ciliated motion, so spinal cord, reproduction, etc., is very, very compromised. I mean, they have a lot of problems in breathing, etc., and reproducing as well. So another example of influence of physics. And actually, there is a cartoon, which I couldn't resist in showing, especially because it's Hollywood and I promised to make it light. You usually have a laugh out of this, because these people have actually had this bat, this pretty rigid cilia propelling food around, and it's supposed to be doing something in the development of the embryo. Okay, so this is not a cartoon, this is actually a real simulation, immerse boundary problem or technology from Lisa Fauci at Tulane, a 2D simulation in which you actually show, it's not clear that how you propel things in Stokes flow, or given that we are at the, I should have said that actually, the scale that we are in this biological system is so small that even if the fluid is water, it's still a very, very small Reynolds number. So it behaves effectively like at the macroscopic level is a very, very sticky fluid. And so if it sticks, it's very hard to move it, right? And of course, there is an issue about orientation of your surfaces that allows you to move the fluid. And this is a demonstration that this can be done, at least in a direct numerical simulation with this immerse boundary technology. Now the question is, for somebody in our area is, well, okay, it moves. You've seen the markers that were over here, now they're here. But how can I test this? Okay, and we got involved in this work for this part. In fact, for the nodal cilia in the embryo, because they're very, very rigid, and or thought to be so. And the physicists downstairs, Rich Superfine, they are trying to mimic. So now we're bringing to back to the mission. Okay, we're gonna what they wanted to do. And they're doing, in fact, we're going to build a replica of the actual biological thing so that we can actually change parameters at will and see what happens to things that are physically relevant, like propulsion of the fluid. So they built this nanorods, which are soft magnetic materials, and they actuate their motion with magnets. And you can see a picture of it. This is a close-up. So there is a fabrication process that you go through, and then there is an actuation process that you have to engineer. These guys are invented or more or less patented this technology. These are ways of focusing your magnetic field on a very, very small region, about 100 microns or so. Okay, and effectively you're creating magnetic monopoles by dispersing the other polarity over the by using the geometry over a much broader volumetric area. And there is an interesting problem about how to actually actuate this rod, which has to do with inverse problems, right? I mean, you want to know how to move your coils, move the current in your coils to generate a prescribed motion. You know the motion that you want. You have to reconstruct the motion of the current, okay? Which we participated in. It was a lot of fun, and we got somewhere, but I'll show it in a moment. Now, if you also have a computer science collaborator and has got a student who's sitting around doing nothing, so you can actually tell him, why don't you do an animation of all this so that it gives you a perspective of what scales we're talking about. And so this guy did a very nice job. What these people can do is stick little beads onto cilia and pull them with this magnetic tweezers, and you know, again, in the spirit of doing science, you want to measure forces, for instance, and things that are physically relevant.
Those are the types of debates.
Let me go back. Yes. What is attached to the base?
So then these little fibers there.
Okay. The fibers that in the animation are supposed to be the real thing. Actually, they're attaching the beads to the living cilia. Okay, and they're attached to the base. I mean, they grow actually on Gore-Tex. No, it's not the nano yet. The nano, in fact, is this actually. So this is the very first synthetic cilia. Realization. That's how we got into this problem. And the actuation is not perfect, as you can see. The rod is moving, but it's probably tilted a little bit. But they came by and said, okay, look at this bead. It's basically doing some sort of vibration, which is probably Brownian motion, but it's doing an overall rotating motion. So the fluid maybe is rotating around.
The magnetic field is operating on that rod, but not touching the fluid.
Oh,
it's
no.
Well,
I mean, the bead is actually glass. It's not magnetic in this case. Yeah, thanks, actually. The rod is being moved.
It's only the rod.
Yeah, and the flow that the rod generates is marked by the bead. Mm-hmm. And the bead is a 1 micron sphere, so it's not exactly a small one. Okay, so we got into this project. We did the inverse problem. We managed to do, I don't know if you noticed, but that motion that we had before was more like a triangle, boink, 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 like this, right? Like reflecting the geometry. So we got into this coil business, how to move the current around. We had, the problem is not unique, actually. The solution is not unique. So we prescribed the current. We went to these guys, these guys thanked us and went along without doing anything that what we said that would be optimal. So we had a little bit of interactions, and eventually they got our solution. It didn't work, but by twisting and turning the knobs, eventually it got to, this is a montage of several pictures, okay, of the tip of the rod, and it's almost conical or round, okay, and this is the track. These are actually, again, montage of the location of the beads, several beads in the picture. Now, as you might see immediately now, this motion that was actually around this azimuthal circular motion is not really random, right? Your eye immediately picks up some certain frequency. And that was interesting to us. So we started tracking this bead. This is fantastic software developed by another colleague of ours in math, Data Tank. It does just about anything you ask it to do, including coffee sometimes, maybe. It's not quite, but it's not just for tracking things. But you can see what happens. So what you're seeing here is the rod. It's a 100 nanometers rod, by the way, in diameter. Light, this is normal microscope. Light is, you know, at the very least, maybe it's 500 or so nanometers in green light. So it's a question of what you're seeing in reality. It looks a lot fatter than it is, because what you're seeing is actually an interference main peak, actually. Kind of interesting to realize that's true. And this is a sphere. The sphere is actually a micrometer, so
what's
you actually can see it. The fluid is water.
Water.
Yeah, just water. Okay, so math. I'll just skip through this, because most people know, it's Navier-Stokes. You are in a situation in which viscous forces dominate. You can dig this all up by looking at things like the Reynolds number. The Struve number is actually taking care of the time dependency in this process. You discover that they're very, very small, so you knock this term, which is nasty because it's nonlinear, you knock the time derivative, and you're in business. Way to go. You have the Stokes flow, which is a lot simpler, it's linear. But unfortunately, Stokes flows are not exactly trivial, and, fortunately, maybe. And actually, they're very counterintuitive. I hope I will be able to show you something that is not immediately obvious. Okay, so where is the non-obvious part coming from? Well, it's actually coming from the boundary conditions. If you have boundary conditions which are time dependent, it's not like linearity helps you all that much in order to write down solutions. So what you can do, one of the things you can do is look at Green's functions, okay? Because the problem truly is linear. And I don't want to focus on this so much. I'll just mention that this technology goes back, I mean, there is a lot of this Stokes' flow equation that is reminiscent of harmonic analysis, or rather on Laplacian or Laplace's equation. And you can, but it's not, because there is a divergence-free condition, it's a vector form, and so on and so forth. But people back in the old days were looking at Laplace's equation very carefully for things like, oh, if I have a gravitational body of a certain shape, what is the gravitational field? Out of the sphere, of course, which is the easy thing. So these people, it goes a whole string of classical people who worked on it. And Chang and Wu, and actually tip of the hat to Ted Wu, who was my co-advisor, in fact. But I joined this group when he was long lost interest in this class of problems, so I did Waze. So I didn't know about all this. I had to discover it, you know, through the literature. And anyway, one way to efficiently hook up solutions for this problem is to distribute singularities, the Green's function that I just flashed by before, in an efficient way. I mean, you can also try to solve the PD, and then you run into either numerics or summing infinite series of spherical harmonics. Neither of them is bad, but it's not explicit. And it's just fortunate that if you do this distribution of singularities, we were able to find an exact solution. I mean, exact solutions, of course, they are of limited value, maybe, but for testing numerics, for instance, are very, very valuable. At least my experience with that is so. And what is this exact solution? Basically, it's a spheroid, namely an ellipsoid with two axes equal, elongated as much as you want. That doesn't really matter. And it's doing this cone-like precession. It's a double cone now, okay? And which is reminiscent of what the rod in this guy's experiment could do if you, for a moment, neglect the fact that there is a plane. Okay, and but an exact solution is an exact solution, and it's always nice to have. So we plow, you know, plowed ahead. If you want to know the exact solution, it's still not exactly that it fits in one page. So it's exact, it's explicit. All these functions can be, well, these integrals can be evaluated, but you know, D1, D12, and there's D14, and so on. Right, in appendix D of our paper, who is due to appear sometime in JFM. Anyway, so what you do with that, once you construct this exact solution, you have now the velocity field, and you can actually follow what the fluid particles are doing. And this is what they're doing in this animation that Terry Joe put together with Data Tank again. By the way, Data Tank is able to do all sorts of things, as I said. And you realize that, indeed, you have this epicycle motion, okay, which is very reminiscent of what the track speed we're displaying. So it's not Brownian motion, to make a long story short, that you can input this flickering about. There's actually a very deterministic part of it. And again, we are in the nanometer type regime, or hundreds of nanometers. And so this is where the continuum begins to, you know, raise flags, right, the continuum hypothesis. So it's very comforting to see that the continuum theory can actually capture something that you see at these scales. So there is a totally different spin on that, which I'm not going to talk about. But here is the difference initial conditions. Yeah, pun intended. different initial conditions of where you put your track your particle, the fluid particles, what they would do to the motion, right? You can interrogate this, and so you have this structure or this other structure, and I have to point with more old-fashioned things. Okay, so this is very close to the rod. This is further away. And let's see, just for fun, you can also put two lines of, say, dye, okay, and watch how they moved under the influence of a very, very elongated spheroid. And it's looking very realistic. In fact, I'll show you in a second something along these lines. Okay, from the math viewpoint, It's kind of interesting to notice that if you go to a rotating frame, and this is a plug for the students, and it goes along with the discussion of yesterday about carrying a passport. I wouldn't have been able to cook up a non-trivial example of a dynamical system, a 3D set of ODEs, that would exhibit such an interesting behavior, because it turns out that, okay, so you have your body, okay, and you have this motions of the fluid particles around it. We are now in the body frame of reference, so the body is fixed, the fluid is rotating at infinity, flowing around the body, and somehow it turns out that all the orbits that we can find, okay, or check, they turn out to be periodic orbits. Now, from the point of view of dynamics or dynamical systems, this is pretty peculiar. It's synonym of complete integrable systems, but systems usually come in one variety. The ones I'm familiar with, most people are familiar with, come in with a variety of having conserved quantities and all that kind of stuff. Here, there isn't anything, actually, and it's been pretty interesting, pretty intriguing, but we don't have a mathematical answer to this, other than some mumbo-jumbo words about geometric integrability and all that. So back to the more realistic phenomenon, okay, we have a plane, okay, the plane again is a non-slip boundary condition, so that has to have an influence on the dynamics. You can now forget about exact solution, but you can still get some mileage out of asymptotic solution. So you now you assume that your body is very, very thin compared to its length, and you can still distribute your singularities. It's not a pretty exercise. This guy Blake did it in, again, 1971. If you think about how old this stuff is, it's relatively recent. So this is a way, the Green's function, the presence of a plane. And it's not just a method of image, it is a method of image, but you have to be careful because this is Stokes' law, and you're killing three components of velocity, so you have three different types of images that you have to use for every singularity that you put in space above the plane. So it's a nice and tricky thing. So now it's time to do the comparison with theory and data. So this is a video tracked microscopic experiment or nanoscale experiment of a bead, and you can look at things like, for instance, what's the amplitude of these oscillations, okay, and plot it versus what the radius of this orbit is, okay, and we did that, and the physicists were all gung-ho and happy about these curves. These are several curves. I don't want to go into the details of this, okay? There are several curves because we are comparing the exact solution, which is without the plane, with the plane, different radii of the rod. And you might ask why. Well, because they do manufacture the rods according to some standards and precision, but then when they put them in water, these things collect stuff, okay? And they actually grow in size a little bit. So we're trying to show the sensitivity basically on this parameter, which is not perfectly known, and they were very very happy and good, but we weren't being mathematicians, I guess, in some sense, we were not completely happy, and we wanted to actually eliminate one as much as possible out of this uncertainties. In this experiment. So what you don't know? Well, what you don't know is a lateral view. You can only see from the top, from the microscopic experiment, because of the microscope, you cannot see from the side. There are literally thousands and thousands of these rods in a squirt, a little droplet of water, right, on a piece of glass, and they look under the microscope and then go around until they see some rods that are very well isolated and standing up, by the way, some of them are not able to stand up, right? And then they actuate them. So we decided, okay, why don't we use a dynamic similarity? I mean, we know fluids, right? And we can scale up using much more viscous fluids than water. We can scale up to tabletop type experiments. So that's what we did. Leah Vici and Jonathan Toledo. Jonathan was a freshman when he started working on this experiment. And Leah is faculty in computer science. So it's a truly interdisciplinary type effort. Leah, for some reason, has a lab, a mechanical shop, in fact, in the computer science department. So she routed out a hole in an old table, put a magnet from a loudspeaker, and actually did in the very same way as the microscopic experiment, a pin. You know, it's a, really a pin. Okay, it's a piece of a paperclip at the very first, it's, which is sitting here lonely in the, at the bottom of this tank full of corn syrup. Okay, corn syrup is very viscous. Here is another picture of this pin. Then we got a little bit more sophisticated. We also painted the pin. And then we used air bubbles for tracers instead of beads. And here is what happens. So we had initially Jonathan managed to put down a string of beads actually in a line, and you can see what they do according to their distance from the pin. This is the top view. By the way, this is a montage of stills from a still camera, okay, because it really goes so slowly now to maintain a dynamic similarity, so it's not moving anywhere close to that speed. I mean, you really go, almost literally go to take a cup of coffee and take another picture, another cup of coffee, and so on. You stay awake also. So here is the data tank story, and you notice that, well, okay, it's very well regular, okay. The radius is changing a little bit. The amplitude of the oscillations actually is changing a little bit. But this can be accounted for when you think these are actually bubbles, so they tend to rise, okay, over the course of the experiment. So, and here is a more quantitative view, okay, so here is the grand finale, so to speak, of this story. We compare the trajectories from the asymptotic theory with the plane, the free space exact solution, and the actual experiment. Okay, so near field, and this is of course the cone radius of spanned by the rod during this. And near field, it's okay. Actually, all three of them are in general agreement. But the free space is actually going too fast, and it becomes very, very obvious if you go on the bubbles that are far away from the origin of the pin. So we were happy. We plotted the amplitude of the oscillations or the epicycles, and I usually get to show this, but I don't want to. Actually, this is about a question about is it really a passive thing to follow a bubble? I mean, a bubble of size, or a bead for that matter, right? I mean, we are actually looking at we are solving for fluid particle motion, okay? But we are looking at macroscopic objects. So in order to emphasize this, we actually put a real big bead, okay, in the fluid. Here is the pin. Here is a bubble. And usually, I make money out of not really, but I ask the audience to place bets. And so they all go around, okay, but who goes faster? And the people who have seen this talk before, of course, they're not allowed to bet. But I'll skip this also because I have the feeling that being steeped in biology, I'm going to lose money actually. So let me go on to I can show it at the end if you want. Reversibility. Okay, this is an exercise in which you show this well-known fact that Stokes' law are reversible. So we put the line of dye, if you remember the previous simulation, right, down, we color, use food coloring, and we move the pin, the shadow is detached from the point where it's resting because there is a thickness of the plexiglass at the bottom, right? So, and as you can see, it's almost reversible. We could have easily cheated and showed you the reconstruct the montage of the stills backward, and you probably would have bought it. But actually, no. I mean, if you notice, there is diffusion. That is a telltale thing that we didn't cheat, actually. Okay. Now, on to the stuff that I really want to talk about. I mean, this is fairly new. Jonathan is a pretty interesting fellow, actually. He's now graduated and moved on to theoretical physics. So we cured him for forever about doing experiments and getting dirty with corn syrup. On the other hand, he asked the question, what if I bend the pin? And he said, okay, bend the pin, right? I mean, it should be pretty much the same thing as this. And so the picture from the top shows that, yes, I mean, these bubbles are being moved around more or less the same way. So we were happy to see that, and we told you so, type thing. But then if you look from the side, Okay, so this is tracking, a very poor tracking because we had a poor camera at the time from the side. We used the inferior D1 Nikon camera from the side, which doesn't have enough frame rate. But you can see that you start from here and you end up there. And it's a bubble. The bubble would like to go up and you go down. So this bending of the pin has a dramatic effect. And now if you think about, you know, the role of this thing as moving around fluid and conveying nutrients to various parts of your domain, that might be an important effect. Mm-hmm. So we decided to chase it a little bit more systematically. So we manufactured pins, which are actually done by Leah, who's a fantastic engineer. She wrote all the plans for pins, cut it and sharpened it, and here's a movie of one of these pins in fluid. Now we are also able to make bubbles, which are actually droplets of fluid, which is neutrally buoyant. Mm-hmm. So we eliminated this part, okay. And I don't want to show the whole movie because it's a little bit like watching grass grow. But you can see first of all in real time now. This is real time because we're using a camcorder now. And if you convince yourself that the bead was behind the pin and this is going this way, right? You can see what happens if I accelerate this. You can see that this bubble is going, or droplet, is going down and getting distanced away until we lost it. Okay, so what is the, now we broke a symmetry here. Okay, because we had this, and now we have a belly, and it's a question of orientation of the belly. So we call this thing scooping, because the belly is like this. Okay, it's tangent to the cone. And that's where you push this bubble down. Now, by reversibility of fluid motion, you also know a priori that if your belly was out, anti-scooping, if you want, you would actually have the same motion. That's cool. Here is a tracking of this trajectory that you've seen. So you start somewhere out here, and you go down, 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 and then you start going back up. But you're going back up and gaining radius. And so the question is, what happens here? So how do you make sense of these spaghetti things? Well, it's a classical thing in dynamical systems, right? You do a Poincaré map, and here's the schematic for the people who are not familiar with Poincaré maps. You basically keep track of where your trajectory intersects a fixed location plane, okay, in your domain. And you can do it in the moving frame of reference, so where the body is fixed. Okay, so if you do this, numerically you can do it, but we're trying to do it also with the experiment to some extent. This is what you get. Actually, it's kind of interesting. So if you have the belly in, okay. So now you've broken a symmetry, but not really. I mean, you're spanning some sort of a martini glass instead of a perfect cone, okay. What happens is actually the Poincaré map shows you. You started. This is a grid of initial points, and superimposed on them is the actual intersection. So say the plane that I showed before in the schematic is this one. Okay, what happens there is you intersect exactly where you started. So this is, as a Poincaré maps go, it's pretty boring. It's the identity map. And it doesn't get more integrable than that. Actually, it's a very integrable thing. And why is that, actually? We don't know, but it's definitely an effect that we already saw before, because we saw that there were only periodic orbits in this flow. Now, the moment you make this thing scooping, you can see that it's scooping because you see only the beginning and end part of this rod, okay, schematic here. You develop all this toroidal motion, which is familiar to people in dynamical systems. Now, it still doesn't say whether it's integrable or not, but it certainly does say something about the effectiveness of the mixing of just a little angle of scooping. Problem. So we broke a symmetry and we drive the flow close to the plane, for instance, one of the things it does. And okay, again, no theory. I mean, we have the ODEs, it's all very much explicit, but why is that? Not quite sure, actually. Let me also mention one thing that is also kind of astounding. So we asked now Jonathan graduated, so we have two new guys, Pavel and David. Who are actually sophomore? They were freshmen this past year, were also doing, you know, very, very good work. And they decided at some point to do this scooping and then stop the magnet, reverse, and do the anti-scooping. And the bubble didn't reverse. I mean, the bubble didn't track back onto its orbit. And we're saying, no, something else happened, right? Well, it's actually astounding, I think, because there is a very small drift. These are bubbles. So it's about 10 to the minus 3 of the peak velocity that you can measure in this flow, okay, the rising velocity. But even that small perturbation, which is obviously non-reversible because you always go up unless you go in Australia. So even that small perturbation is sufficient to destroy completely the symmetry between scooping and anti-scooping. So this is scooping, this is anti-scooping, and you see that it wipes out this toroidal structures almost completely. It's kind of interesting because I was not expecting such a small perturbation to destroy this reversibility so much, actually. Again, it just goes around to tell you that Stokes flows are, you might think you know, but not quite. And so this is the orbit that they tracked with the bubble. Okay, it starts somewhere around here, it goes down and then goes up again and then you lose it. Okay, as I said, I want to quickly finish. There is another way of breaking the symmetry. Keep the rod straight, but now don't span a perfectly upright cone. Make it, around an axis which is tilted. So you push through it close to the plane. The plane is a stick plane, not a slip plane, so it's got to have an influence. Another thing that, again, we thought, it's going to tilt the orbits, right? No. I mean, yes, it does tilt some of the orbits. Sure, you push it against the plane. But there's something else that happens, which namely has to do with, the possibility of open orbit. Okay, that was not completely expected, and we don't have a proof again whether there are or there are no, orbits that are open, so they stream all the way to infinity. Obviously, this is an important effect for optimal transport, maybe.
So what's the difference between two pictures?
So what we're trying to see here is basically in the name of hurry, I forgot to say all sorts of things, actually. So this is one orbit started somewhere, actually here, okay? And it tracks around this. And what you see is the instantaneous position of, now it's the stick is really a stick, right? Mm-hmm. And here is the same deal. You see the cone now from a different perspective, more 3D-like perspective. And there are several initial conditions, okay. And most of these initial conditions, except one, okay, do close orbits, but one seems to escape.
But it's the same tilt.
Same tilt. I mean, just different initial conditions, okay. And if you see things from the top, okay, these are closed orbits, but there's one which is not too far away, okay. It seems to go away, okay? And of course, it goes away, and as it moves further and further out, it slows down because the velocity is decaying like 1 over r, in fact, okay? So it becomes a chore to actually follow it. But it's a question whether or not it will eventually come back. But it's a pretty dramatic effect. I mean, this is a very small percentage difference in x location, same height. And there is a very dramatic effect which I wasn't expecting it. Again, goes to show how much I know. Okay, so I want to finish. Challenges that we have, well, many. I mean, in order to bring it even closer to being useful for reality, we would have to, include things like multi-layers, many bodies, of course. I mean, just one single isolated cilium out there would not be particularly interesting, although, again, it's quite interesting for purpose of validation of numerics. We actually did something so now we have this flow, we understand it very well, I think, to some extent, theoretically. It would be nice to actually do some more interesting stressing of DNA molecules. People put this DNA molecules to understand their physical properties. In very simple flows, elongational flows or shear flows, how about something which is temporal varying might provide some information. We did a little foray into that. We means Superfine and others. We couldn't quite make much of it because of lack of very megabox instruments. Basically, we didn't have. We didn't. At some point, I have a little bit of time and just to end on a happy note. These guys were actually asking for demos. Hold them for about 2 weeks. Get desperately data, you know, of these fast cameras, and then returning them. They didn't have the money to buy them, and of course, all sorts of ethical questions were raised, and we never really published anything there. But anyway, hopefully we'll get some money and get some real gear to follow the DNA in a decent way. And with that, I guess there are many people who contribute to this project. I mean, in a large area of simulating and run. Actually, that's the holy grail type goal that we set for ourselves. And it's truly interdisciplinary, with people from physics, from math, computer science for manipulation and visualization, and on. We only see a very small portion of this funding, but nonetheless, many thanks to all these people. Okay, that's it. Thanks.